coming up on nearly a half century of the Clean Water Act, we look at what the future holds for protecting our nation's waterways and wetlands here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Passed in 1972, the Clean Water Act gives the EPA, gives the Army Corps of Engineers the responsibility to regulate water pollution. And the River Network, it called the Clean Water Act one of the most comprehensive environmental statutes in our country. U.S. Supreme Court, meanwhile, is considering a challenge to could essentially narrow the law's reach. Are you concerned about limitations to the Clean Water Act? Should states exercise more control over which waterways are protected? 800-642-1234. Patrick Parento is a law professor and senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. Pat, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Good morning. Do you view the Clean Water Act as the single most important law we have for achieving water quality standards for our drinking water and really supporting aquatic life? Why has this act been so monumental? Why has it stood the test of time?
Well, there are three basic pillars to the act. One is that there's a regulatory program for what we call point source discharges. These would be industries, factories, pipes, including some large farms in a dairy state like Wisconsin. That's an issue. It also requires states to come up with comprehensive water quality standards, which are the things that are needed to protect beneficial uses, fishing, swimming, fish and drinking water and so forth. Then the federal government has provided a great deal of money to the states to clean up, for example, sewage treatment. At many billions of dollars over the years, there's now a revolving fund available for the states to get loans to improve their sewage treatment facilities and other water quality maintenance programs. And finally, the federal government provides a series of laboratories that do all the kind of research that we need to identify emerging threats to water quality, most recent being what we call these forever chemicals, PFAS, PFOA. There's about 1,000 different compounds and chemicals used in everyday products that science has determined pose threats to human health. So, you know, the federal government through the Clean Water Act has a partnership with the states, and it requires very strong and effective state programs. But without the backup of the federal government, then states are not really able to protect their waters from pollution that's coming downstream from upstream states. So it's a partnership arrangement.
Congress hasn't, though, amended the Clean Water Act for decades. Do you think it needs an overhaul, in your view, in some way?
Oh, it very definitely does. It hasn't been renewed, amended, I should say, since 1987. That was the last comprehensive set of amendments. So we're way out of date with some of these more modern threats, including things like climate change, which is complicating just about everything involving with management of land and water and other resources. So, you know, but the problem, of course, as everybody knows, is that we have a divided Congress, and the environmental issue, including the Clean Water Act, has become a partisan issue. Unfortunately, It shouldn't be, but it has been. So it's been very difficult to get consensus in Congress on what needs to be done to bring the act into the sort of modern 21st era of managing water.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the importance and legacy of the Clean Water Act with Pat Parento. He's a professor of law, senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. You can join in. Are you concerned about what limitations to the Clean Water Act could mean for the future? Have you noticed an increase in pollution in streams or other bodies of water near where you live? Join in on the Clean Water Act, 800-642-1234. Pat, can you explain the scope of the waters of the U.S. terminology and how it applies to the Clean Water Act that is really coming under pressure through the waters of the U.S.?
Yes, Congress exercises the power that it has under our Constitution. When it comes to environmental laws like the Clean Water Act, Congress relies very heavily on the Commerce Clause, which means that you have to have a nexus between the object of your legislation, in this case, clean water, and Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. That's been a really complicated issue over the years. It turns on this definition of navigable waters. So navigable waters are, you know, waters that commerce moves through the waters. You can think about the Great Lakes, obviously, and how much commerce goes across the Great Lakes. So then you get to this question of how far does the concept of navigable waters reach? Because the limit of that terminology is the limit of Congress's authority. So even now, 50 years after the passage of what we call the Modern Clean Water Act, we do not have a definitive Supreme Court decision on the scope of that term navigable waters. The statute, the Clean Water Act, defines navigable waters to include waters of the United States, including the territorial seas off our coastlines. But Congress didn't define waters of the United States. The agencies, EPA, Corps of Engineers, they've come up with a variety of definitions over the years.
And the EPA, I want to just step in here because the EPA is trying to get what it calls a, quote, durable definition of waters of the U.S., which I, you know, kind of find interesting because last November, the EPA announced a proposed rule revising the definition. What do you see there?
Right. So there's been a series of court decisions that have complicated things as happens. And EPA's in the process of revising the definition of waters of the United States, which was adopted by the prior administration. And that decision, that prior rule of the prior administration, struck down by two courts in the western part of the United States, actually. So EPA is in the process through rulemaking, you know, notice and comment, giving people a chance to comment, of coming up with a new rule. And in the meantime, now, as you mentioned at the outset, the Supreme Court has taken a case to review the scope of EPA and the Corps' authority. So that's kind of where we are right now. We're in limbo on exactly what this new definition is going to be.
I wonder, since we've seen over the years several Supreme Court decisions and cases that have really addressed the definition of waters of the U.S., I wonder, do you see these challenges as problematic, or are they showing what needs to change and be defined about the Clean Water Act programs?
Well, we don't have any clarity at this point, I have to say. And there's a lot of concern about the Supreme Court stepping into this process now before EPA and the Corps have been able to come up with a new proposed definition. And, you know, that's a long process. I mean, the agencies are consulting with stakeholders in agriculture, in industry, in housing development. I mean, there's a lot of people that have interest in the way that the federal government regulates the waters of the U.S., right? So, you know, for the court to be stepping in at this point is problematic, at least in my view. It would be better if the court would wait for the agencies to adopt the final rule and then they can review that. But they're going to hear arguments in the fall, and it's going to be hotly contested. And prior Supreme Court decisions have not added any clarity, frankly, to the problem. And Congress hasn't done anything either because of this partisanship and the divide that we have. So we're really kind of stuck at this point, I think, in getting final clarity on exactly what is the reach of the Clean Water Act. How far up into the watersheds does it go? Does it go to headwater streams and their associated wetlands, for example? That's an issue that needs to be resolved.
Environmental law professor Pat Parento, our guide to the Clean Water Act, a test to what constitutes the waters of the U.S. Have you noticed an increase in pollution around you in streams, other bodies of water? Or do you feel there are greater protections over water now than in decades past? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Pat Parento here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Clean Water Act protections and what would happen if the law would be narrowed as the U.S. Supreme Court considers this question again. How closely connected to a navigable river or lake does a body of water have to be for Clean Water Act regulations to apply, and how permanent How permanent must that water be? Are you watching the case Sackett versus EPA? How do you feel about the Clean Water Act at this point versus back in 87? Join in 800-642-1234. Vermont Law School professor Pat Parento is with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. We have Jake joining us from Appleton. Jake, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. You know, I just was thinking about maybe something that I haven't heard discussed yet regarding clean water and water quality, which is more like invasive species. It seems like every day or every summer when I go to a random boat launch or something, there's still milfoil, still invasive snails. I mean, is there any aspect of that may tackle that in a greater way? I know that it hasn't gotten any better, but I don't think it's gotten any worse. So I just want to know kind of if there's any provisions there for, you know, maybe more of a organic matter or things like that.
Jake, thank you for that question. Pat, what would you say there?
Well, the Clean Water Act is not a very good vehicle to address invasive species, which, as the caller points out, is really a massive problem across the country. There are other federal laws that deal with invasive species. One area that might be of interest to your listeners on the Great Lakes is, you know, you have a lot of international boats coming into the Great Lakes with you know, products and so forth, commerce, and they have ballast water.
Yes.
They used to be able to discharge the ballast water directly into the Great Lakes. That has been stopped. And the Clean Water Act does regulate ballast water discharges, and it requires particularly that these ships that are coming from all over the world, God knows what's in their tanks, right? So there's now a program for that specific source of invasive species. But more generally, we don't really that's one of the needs for updating these laws. We don't really have effective ways of preventing these invasive species from getting into these water bodies. Once they're there, what we know is it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get them out.
Let's bring on Jeff now in Delafield. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I seem to have noticed the increase in or degradation of water quality in the last, I don't know, 20 years, and I would attribute it to changes in agricultural practices. As agriculture has become more industrialized, we hear about destruction of grasslands across the plains, and all of that results in more nutrient runoff into our lakes and rivers, and I just think that is becoming an increasing problem.
Jeff, thank you for that. Pat, what is the impact of agricultural pressures on our water systems?
Yeah, non-point source pollution, runoff, as the caller was identifying, it is the major source of impairment of water in the country. And nutrients are probably the single most significant problem. That's what's causing the creation of dead zones all the way from the Gulf of Mexico. But Lake Erie, for example, has large areas now with low enough oxygen that no life can exist. And agriculture isn't the only source, but it's a major source of nutrient pollution. You get it from sewage treatment plants. You get it from urban runoff as well. But that's another area where the Clean Water Act is not functioning very well because it doesn't require permits for non-point source pollution, for runoff. For large factory farms, there is a permit program, but that's limited, you know, the really largest concentrated animal feeding operations, not the kind of runoff problems that are causing such real significant impairment. That's gonna be more difficult to regulate than pipes and industrial discharges, which we've done a very good job of regulating. That's a lot of land use. And of course, that's something where the states are resistant to having the federal government, quote, dictate or regulate land use practices. So that's a real tough problem to deal with. It requires best management practices. It requires a lot of investment of money and a combination of state and federal money to get that job done and restore these waters. So that's a big to-do for the Clean Water Act.
Talking with Pat Parento, professor of law and senior counsel at Vermont Law School, as we take a closer look at the Clean Water Act and what it does for our waterways and wetlands. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Pat, I want to circle back to PFAS. Federal regulators, they've been aware of the health hazards of forever chemicals for more than two decades, but we haven't seen the EPA set or develop standards for PFAS. Why do you think that is?
EPA is concerned about having a strong administrative record to support whatever number they choose. I mean, when you're talking about PFAS chemicals, we're regulating down in the parts per billion, and in some cases parts per trillion. So, you know, these are incredibly complicated toxicological standards that have to be set. That's why having an agency like EPA with the kind of expertise in these laboratories that come up with the studies that are needed to demonstrate, you know, how do these chemicals move through the environment when they reach, you know, human receptors, what organs are affected by these chemicals and how significantly are they carcinogenic? You know, that's, and you can't experiment on humans. So you have to do that through laboratory kinds of exposures. And then you get those standards challenged by industry that are manufacturing these chemicals, DuPont and 3M and others. And so EPA has to be able to defend whatever number they pick to regulate. So that's where EPA is right now, way behind the eight ball for sure on PFAS chemicals, but a long way to go, I think, unfortunately, before we have really enforceable standards.
Let's bring on David now in La Crosse. David, hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I live in southern Wisconsin. I live in La Crosse. And there's a lot of, you know, small creeks and rivers around here. And we've had the water bottling companies want to come in and start, you know, putting in their wells to produce well bottled water. And I'm worried it'll have an adverse reaction on our small creeks and river systems, because there's a lot of them around here. And if you just, like, they're all connected, you can't just take them and separate them out, being like, this is a river and this isn't a river.
David, thank you for that observation. Pat, what do you see there in bottling companies trying to find the freshest water they can?
Yeah, that's a water allocation, water rights issue. That's a state law question. The Federal Clean Water Act doesn't regulate water withdrawal or water use. But, you know, Wisconsin has a very strong public trust doctrine. And that would be the place to look for protecting streams from large withdrawals for bottling companies. Your neighbor in Michigan had a very significant case involving Nestle sucking enormous amounts of water out of small streams and lakes in the state, and it went all the way to the state Supreme Court. So that's where I would look for remedies for large water withdrawals that are impacting small streams.
I want to circle back to the litigation around the Clean Water Act. And if you could explain a little bit about this case, Sackett versus EPA, that's before the high court, and what you see there.
Yeah, that's about a family in Idaho that has a piece of land next to Priest Lake, which is a large lake, what we would call a traditionally navigable water body. And they do have wetlands on their property. They actually knew they had wetlands on their property. They hired a consultant who told them, you can't fill these wetlands without talking first with the Corps of Engineers. The Sacketts didn't do that because this is a test case. The Sacketts are being represented by a group called Pacific Legal Foundation. The PLF, as we call them, has been bringing these lawsuits for years, trying to roll back the federal jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. So this is another attempt, and this time they got the Supreme Court's attention. I mean, the Sackett case was before the Supreme Court once before, but right now the case that's there is a really serious challenge to federal authority under the Clean Water Act. And it has to do with, you know, what's the relationship between a wetland? This wetland is within 300 feet of Priest Lake, so it's very close. And there's a stream that runs right next to the property as well. So, you know, what combination of connections between wetlands and streams and lakes is necessary to establish federal jurisdiction? That's going to be the question. In an earlier case, a case we call Rapanos, the Supreme Court couldn't agree on what the test should be. It split 4-1-4 among the nine justices on the court. So after that case, the lower courts began to develop what they call a significant nexus test. If there's a significant nexus between the wetland and the lake in this case, then that would provide federal jurisdiction. That's what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals below in the Sackett case ruled. But the Supreme Court has said we are going to review whether or not we agree with the significant nexus test. And because we now have a brand new Supreme Court with three Trump appointees on it, who are very conservative, very suspicious of federal agency assertion of authority. All of us in the sort of environmental community, including academics, are very worried about whether this new, very conservative Supreme Court is going to establish such a stringent test for federal jurisdiction that we could literally be eliminating over half protection for over half of the wetlands in the United States. There are studies that show that. So it's a big deal right now.
Pat, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Pat Parento is a professor of law and senior counsel in the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School. Just ahead, it's a look at the future of replacing lead pipes and the effects of poisoning with our state's lead policy advisor. Do you worry about lead poisoning from lead paint or lead laterals? 800-642-1234 to join in on lead. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Discussing lead poisoning and mitigation efforts on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden was in Ohio last month promoting the importance of removing lead pipes and tying it back to the $1 trillion infrastructure law passed in November. Biden said our country will start to undo the legacy of lead that has poisoned too many children.
Every American, every child should be able to turn on a faucet and know that the water they're drinking is clean and safe. We're also going to create thousands of good-paying jobs in the process with union plumbers and pipe fitters.
Do you worry about lead poisoning from paint in your home or from lead pipes that carry your drinking water? Have you been waiting for your city to replace lead service lines? What's the status? 800-642-1234. Brian Weaver is lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. Can you give us an assessment, a status update, if you will, of what the lead poisoning situation is in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Wisconsin, it's important to remember that there really is no part of the state that's safe from lead poisoning. Every county in Wisconsin has had a lead poisoned child under the age of six. And over the last 25 years, Wisconsin has approximately 230,000 children under the age of six who have been lead poisoned. So it's an issue that's pervasive across the state. But it's important to remember, too, with this issue that there are clear disparities in Wisconsin. And we see that these disparities, health disparities, are brought on by the social and economic conditions that put kids at greater risk of living in housing with lead. So children who live in older housing, and this is pre-1978 housing we're looking at, who experience housing instability and live in poverty are at greatest risk for having dangerous lead hazards in their home environment. So in Wisconsin, this unfortunately means that Black and brown children are at greater risk for being lead poisoned. So if you look at the data, we see an example here that I can highlight is that Black children in Wisconsin accounted for 18% of all children who were tested for lead in their blood in 2019. Mm-hmm. Out of that 18%, they accounted for 45% of all lead poisoning in that year in 2019. So the disparities are quite stark in Wisconsin, that we do see concentration of childhood lead poisoning in cities of Milwaukee, in cities where we have a higher concentration of older housing stock pre-1978, and also housing stock that is perhaps deteriorating and not kept up, and you see chipping and peeling paint and other health hazards potentially in that home environment. With that understood, however, but there are, you know, if we look across Wisconsin, this is an issue that does impact both urban and rural settings. And so we see that in 2019, we saw the highest rates of lead poisoning in counties like Milwaukee, but also in counties like Rusk, Vernon, Sheboygan, Jefferson, and Rock County. So we do have cases and higher rates outside of the city, Milwaukee as well, Wisconsin, is an issue of concern.
I want to probe the environment for a moment here, because sometimes state authorities will pivot and shift the focus away from lead pipes and focus more on the issue of what's in the home, the legacy issue of lead paint. And I'm wondering, is paint a bigger issue than these lead service lines?
So there is no safe level of lead exposure. So we are wanting, from the state perspective, a comprehensive approach and to eliminate any source of lead exposure in a child's environment. What we see in Wisconsin is that the really the lead, childhood lead poisoning is an older housing issue that is attributable to lead paint in housing that is in disrepair. So it's chipping and peeling, there's lead dust. And it is an issue of children who are young. We see the highest rates of lead poisoning between the ages of 1 and 3 because of the fact that these children are exploring their environment, crawling on the floor, you know, cruising around, hanging on to objects like windowsills, where we can see a higher concentration of lead dust if there is deteriorating lead paint in that home environment. And so that hand-to-mouth behavior that those children have at that age increases the chances that they're going to ingest leaded paint, leaded dust into their body and become poisoned that way. So that's primarily where we see the route of exposure in children in Wisconsin and how they're getting lead poison. However, again, because we want to make sure that this child's environment is safe and lead safe, that water definitely is a source that we need to be concerned about. You know, as you opened up this segment, that lead service lines has been a focus area for federal funding and for state funding, and rightly so. People want to be able to drink safe, clean drinking water coming into their house, and lead service lines are an issue in Wisconsin. I believe it's been reported over 170,000 lead service lines in the state. And so we do need to eliminate those sources of lead in the child's environment as well, too. So both are very important. Lead paint is really the primary source of exposure for children in Wisconsin.
Sounds like your programs and policy work really have to tackle multiple fronts on the issue of lead.
Yes, they do. So from the policy perspective, it's important that children have quality and safe housing. So we want to make sure that rental properties, older homes, affordable homes are safe, and that we have oversight over what those environments look like for children. And so it's important that we have the lead service lines being replaced coming into those properties, that we have an assessment of those properties. If there are any hazards, they are identified and remediated and taken care of. So it's important from that. In addition to that, outreach and education to parents is critically important to understand the risks that older housing poses to their child and steps that they can take to make sure that environment is clean and well-maintained, to avoid or reduce the risk of child being exposed to lead. Also, the healthcare, primary care providers.
At the pediatrician's office. Is that what you're... Yes, at those pediatric visits and making sure that children are, I would imagine, being tested for lead exposure or asked the questions very early on. Do you feel like you're able to have those protocols in place?
Yes, more needs to be done in that area with physicians. We have seen, unfortunately, a decrease in blood lead testing over the course of the pandemic, with less frequent office visits, well check visits for a child. WIC clinics was another primary source where we saw blood lead testing being conducted, and a lot of them have gone virtual, where they're providing their services online. So we have seen a significant decrease in blood lead testing in young children. And so there is a need to continue to kind of do the outreach and education to physicians about the importance of asking a parent about the risks potentially in that environment for that child, assessing if that child actually should be tested for lead in their blood and then following through with that blood lead test. So that is critically important.
Talking with Brian Weaver, lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services, you can join in. How do you think the state should address and remove lead from homes? Have you considered, you know, joining litigation because of exposure to lead that, you know, that later led to lead poisoning? 800-642-1234. I just want to suss out a little bit more, Brian. When you say there's been a drop in testing for lead in these pediatric visits, how big of a drop are we talking about?
Well, we're seeing close upwards of 25% decrease as compared to 2019, and that's where the pre-COVID. And so we are continuing to see that steady number as far as fewer children getting blood lead testing. It is higher in the Medicaid population, which is an important population that we monitor in the state because of in Wisconsin, roughly about 85% of our lead poisoned children are on Medicaid. So it is an important population of needing to do outreach and education to the physicians who serve that population. And with that, we are seeing about 30% decrease in children who are on Medicaid receiving the required blood lead test.
And then those children are followed, I would imagine, through life. How do you ensure those children don't fall through the cracks once they do, test high for lead exposure?
Yeah. So local health departments are critical in this step. So when a child is identified with lead poisoning, local health departments often will take action. And so that is typically in the form of a public health nurse doing outreach to the family. And if it's at a level where the child's blood lead level is high enough, they will do a home visit, talk with the family, assess the environment, educate them on remediating any risk, reducing the risk in that environment. And then if it reaches a level where we need a lead risk investigation, an environmental health specialist will come in typically and look at that environment and identify any lead hazards, and then steps are taken to remediate those lead hazards. So follow-up and intervention are critically important for that child so mm-hmm. that we don't continue to expose that child to lead and the lead increases in their blood over time. So immediate intervention is critically important, education of the families. And yes, that child may need follow-up services ongoing to address any deficits from that lead poisoning.
Let's bring on a caller. Jim is joining us from La Crosse to talk about abatement. Jim, go ahead.
Hi. I was a lead risk assessor for a county health department. And what I found was the housing stock was in such poor condition that the abatement actually cost more than the property was worth. Mm. So that was a real impediment to getting any solution to the problem.
Jim, thank you for bringing that to the table. Brian, what about that issue when the abatement would cost more than the property is worth?
We do see that on occasion where the property is in such poor condition that the abatement efforts are at a high cost. We tend to look at with the funding that we have targeted towards abating properties in low-income households through our Lead Safe Homes program. Children need to be living there, and we set it up where that, you know, it's a family that's living in that household, or it's a rental property where that landlord is renting to low-income families, that we actually look at the cost savings from that, fixing that property up for looking at generations to come. If we're able to prevent a child from being lead poisoned, there are huge societal cost savings because of that. So we actually look at more of the impact on the public health versus Looking at the property alone and the cost of the property.
Brian Weaver with us, lead policy advisor within the State Health Department. Have you had lead paint or lead pipes removed from your home? What was that like? How do you feel about Wisconsin's lead abatement and mitigation efforts? What lead programs are most effective in other states that you want to bring here? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brian Weaver here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Biden administration issued guidance to states this week that it said will ensure the country's largest ever investment in water infrastructure doesn't bypass disadvantaged communities. The EPA's guidance memo applies to $43 billion in the infrastructure law for replacing lead pipes and making safer water in communities that often get passed over and have high rates of poverty. Do you feel like your community or family has been passed over in state and federal efforts to clean up environmental hazards like lead poisoning? What do you hope for out of the latest federal investment? 800-642-1234. Brian Weaver is Wisconsin's lead policy advisor with us for about 9 more minutes. Brian, take us to these federal dollars coming in from the infrastructure law. What will they mean to Wisconsin and the issue of lead poisoning?
Yeah, it's a historic investment. We're looking at Wisconsin receiving hundreds of millions of dollars over the next, I believe, 5 years to provide safe drinking water. And so a significant part of those dollars are going to replace lead service lines throughout Wisconsin. And the first installment of those dollars, I believe, are already beginning to arrive in cities across the state. So it will be a significant investment, increase in resources that the state is able to dedicate and support local municipalities in replacing their lead service lines.
Do you think it will expedite the current approach to replacing lead service lines, that it will not take generations to get the lead out?
It's a start, and absolutely it will accelerate the efforts to replace lead service lines. An issue that we do need to be mindful of in this effort and in any increase in funding that goes into remediating lead hazards is that we do need a qualified workforce to do the work so that they're doing it safely. They're not exposing themselves or their coworkers or their family to take home lead. And also the what work is done in a way that it doesn't create additional hazards and actually remediate and fixes the problem that they're working on so that it is lead safe. So workforce is a critical element to this, and that is part of many of the funding sources that are coming in to support this work, is that not only do they focus on remediating and fixing the problem, that is like replacing lead service lines, but also a portion of those dollars are going in to build up the workforce so we have the capacity to do this work and to do it well.
So what I'm hearing is that there are inherent risks to this work that involve remediation of lead, and that you really have to focus on also worker safety and building up the workforce as well.
That is correct, yes. And so, if we look at lead abatement in a house, the first thing that any property owner should do is making sure that if they're going to remediate or address a lead hazard in their property or even do kind of any rehab work in a property that's pre-1978, is that those workers need to be certified to work with lead paint. And there is a Wisconsin certification process for that. So you want to make sure that you are asking those questions. The people that are coming in to work on your property are certified and trained, and they do it in a way that reduces any chance that people will be exposed to lead during the work on the property and afterwards as they clean up and complete the work.
Brian Weaver with us, lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. Brian, I want to look at the role of paint manufacturers and what responsibilities they have in this, because a Wisconsin federal judge just recently threw out claims in 7 lawsuits by people who alleged they were exposed as children to lead in paint made by Sherwin-Williams, made by DuPont and other manufacturers. And so this was a clear win for the manufacturers who are trying to, you know, fend off these lawsuits. What responsibility do paint manufacturers bear in their products?
When we look at this problem, that we do know it's a lead paint issue, and that if paint is not well maintained, leaded paint, that over time it can put lead in the environment. So as far as solutions and looking at the way we can address this issue, I'll be honest with you, I've been focusing on where we have those resources available to us. And so we have been fortunate in Wisconsin to leverage federal and state dollars to abate older properties and make them lead safe. So what that means is that we're able to go in and remove or contain any potential lead paint hazards in those environments. So I've been really focusing our time and attention on that. That really is an important program, the Lead Safe Homes program in Wisconsin. So really been trying to push that and promote that as a solution, not the only solution, but a solution to this issue.
I was surprised there was a recall as recently as last month for children's stackable toys, Adam the Apple, due to the surface paint on the wood toys containing levels of lead that exceed our federal lead paint ban. Why is this still happening?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. There are other sources of potential lead hazards in our environment. So we've talked about lead service lines, the kind of water infrastructure that brings water into our houses, the paint in our houses. But there are also other products that can be brought into the home environment that potentially could pose a threat. So toys are one of those things that are regulated. So we try to catch that, prevent those toys from coming into the home of a child, but it is an issue. And so we do have the ability to regulate and catch those. If we hear complaints, if we understand there might be a potential source, the Division of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection is able to go out there, investigate those, and actually look to see if those products pose a risk to a child. But really the way the system works is that we try to make sure they get caught before they come into the country, into the United States. So we stop from those products from actually getting into circulation, getting to the environment where a child can play with those. But it does happen. And those are products that are imported in from outside the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We only have a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, what can I, as a parent, do today to make sure my home is lead safe? What are some actions and steps we can do today?
So the most important thing is message out there is if you live in an older house pre-1978, you can do this yourself, a visual assessment to see if there's any paint that potentially is breaking down on the walls, inside, outside of the home, on the chipping, peeling paint, or windowsills, door jams, if there's friction points and the paint is wearing away. You want to make sure that those areas are well cleaned, that you clean those up on a regular basis, and that you do bring in a qualified lead risk assessor to come in and inspect the property to let you know if there are lead hazards in that environment. So it's important to understand kind of what you're dealing with before you then determine what the solutions are. If you feel like your child is at risk of being exposed to lead, asking your physician for a blood lead test for your child is critically important as
being
well.
Being so proactive there. Yes. Brian,
exactly.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Brian Weaver, lead policy advisor for the State Department of Health Services. Stay with us as we explore the world of typewriters. There is a resurgence of typewriters. Do you own one? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.